Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the American South. I'm your host, Brandon Jett. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Dr. Ariella J. Gross, the John B. and Alice R. Sharp Professor of Law and History and the co-director of the Center for Law, History, and Culture at the University of Southern California, Gould School of Law. Her research and writing focus on race, racism, and slavery in the Americas, and she is the author of several books, including What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America, and Double Character, Slavery and Mastery in the Antebellum Southern Courtroom. Today, we're talking about her most recent book, Becoming Free, Becoming Black, Race, Freedom, and Law in Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. This book, which was co-authored by Alejandro de la Fuente, explores the creation of race in the Americas from the colonial period to abolition. Through an examination of three slave societies, Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, Gross and De La Fuente argue that as slaveholders in each society attempted to make blackness synonymous with slavery, it was laws regulating freedom, not slavery, that established the subordinated status of black people. Laws that regulated the lives and institutions of free people of color created boundaries between white and black, the rights reserved to white people, and the degradations imposed only on black people. Equally important, as a comparative study, the book demonstrates the divergent trajectories of free people of color in Cuba and the U.S. South. Dr. Gross, welcome to New Books in the American South.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First and foremost, congratulations on the book. What really drew me to this is the comparative nature of it, and I'm assuming that's also what drew you and Alejandro together, because I think you do a really nice job of placing the South in this larger kind of Atlantic world context, which I think is really special and really important. I think oftentimes we understand the South solely in relation to the North, and you really shatter those in a lot of ways. So I was hoping you could give us a little bit of insight into where this collaboration really grew out of and why you thought it was so important to examine these three slave societies.
Yeah, absolutely. As you suggest, you know, we're both really interested in thinking more about law in a comparative and more global or at least more regional context in terms of New World slave societies. And I think we came to the collaboration from somewhat different places in that for me, in What Blood Won't Tell, I had been looking at racial identity and really interested in expanding our ideas of the South as a place where there's a lot of middle ground between black and white, and in contrast to, I think, an idea that many people have had that the U.S. South is really black and white. And often that was in contrast to Latin America, which is portrayed as this, you know, really multiracial, fluid. And so for me, it was, wow, after seeing how big the middle grounds were in the United States, how would that change our idea of the comparison with Latin America? Because that had been such a traditional contrast in comparative studies. Whereas I think for Alejandro, he was coming to it. First of all, I think Latin American studies in general are much more implicitly comparative. That they're, because the historiography is so dominated by the U.S., Latin Americanists are always making that comparison. And in his case, I think he was having already worked a lot on freedom suits and Cortacion in Cuba, was, you know, really in some ways almost coming from the opposite direction, thinking, you know, that the contrast was going to be greater. Whereas I was sort of coming from the, actually, there are a lot of commonalities. And I think that that was a good productive, you know, I don't want to say disagreement, but sort of it was productive that we were coming from different presumptions and assumptions and could kind of test them against each other as we were working on it. But both of us are really committed to a combination of taking a comparative approach, but doing it from the bottom up. And that seems somewhat new to us in legal studies.
So how did you both come together to even begin to have these conversations? Was this just a random chance or had you known each other for quite some time?
Right. I think that there we could actually thank the historian Rebecca Scott, who in the early 2000s started convening these groups of, I think she called it the Law in Slavery and Freedom or something like that. Now I can't even remember exactly the name of the working group, but kind of gathered together in particular legal historians from several continents. And we were gathering and meeting in Michigan, where she was, but also in Brazil and at various conferences, putting on panels and so on. And so Alejandro and I met through that collaboration. So it was also just part of a larger conversation about comparative law and slavery and thinking in a broader Atlantic context that a number of us have been having for some period of years. And then Alejandro early on tried to persuade me that we should work on a book together. And I was
that was going to be my next question. Who approached who?
I know I had to really be talked into it. I was really not convinced because historians don't do that very often.
No,
actually.
No.
There are very few collaborations. So we did a couple of articles first, which was
test the water a little bit, see how it goes.
Test the water. We did a big literature review, which I think was really helpful to kind of think about what the big questions were. And but I was just not sure kind of how it would work. And we're quite different temperamentally or you know, in terms of art, like, I feel like writing comes very easily to Alejandro. Mm-hmm, for me, it's sometimes torture.
Doesn't that just make you mad when writing comes easy to people? I'm the same way. I'm like, oh, it just makes me so mad how quickly you just pulled that all together.
Totally. And also, I'm always racked with anxiety, like, oh, you know, is this going to work? Is this argument going to work? Is this, you know, where is this going? I don't know if we can do it. And Alejandro has this incredible, and it's an amazing quality of like, it's going to be great. This book is going to be so great. It's going to be so important.
He wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong. I'll say that.
So that's great. And a collaborator sort of carries you through like, well, I don't know if I can do it, but he says we can.
After people hear this podcast, he's going to get requests from all around the country,
right?
People wanting to collaborate with him now.
Totally, they should.
Well, I love the idea of the collaboration. And as I suggested, I also just love the idea of placing the U.S. South, since this is a podcast about the U.S. South, in this broader conversation. But I was also interested in how you came up with the three societies. Why Virginia, why Louisiana, and why Cuba? What do you think it was about these three places that really provided some insight that perhaps was lacking?
Sure. So, I mean, Alejandro is an expert on Cuba.
Sure.
And so by definition, when the two of us started working together, we were thinking about some way of doing a Cuba-U.S. comparison. But the choice of where in the U.S. wasn't obvious. And Virginia, you know, has some really obvious claims because, first of all, if we're thinking about the timing, you know, Cuba's settled very early compared to any of the what eventually become part of the United States. And Virginia is the first, of course, to import Africans in bondage, and it's also historically been such a focus of the historiography about origins of slavery and racism, as well as of comparison. You know, Herbert Klein had compared Virginia and Cuba. It was sort of that was sort of like the classic, and then I really wanted to add Louisiana, partly because I had already, I'd never worked on Virginia, but I'd done a lot of work on Louisiana before, and I knew what an interesting and important place it was. It turned out to be important in more ways than we could have guessed. So one is that it's this hybrid in terms of the you know, legal traditions, right? It goes from being French to Spanish to the U.S. So that's kind of cool to be able to see how things change as the legal system changes. It's also New Orleans is such a crossroads, especially for facing the Caribbean, Cuba and Saint-Domingue and so on. And so there were a lot of really interesting kind of circulations. And I think that was important. It was important to us that it's comparative, but it's also, it's not comparing three hermetically sealed societies that don't have anything to do with each other. It's, there are all of these global circulations and having New Orleans as part of it really just makes that so clear and evident and important. So that was the argument for including Louisiana. I think if there's a criticism, you know, and my dear friend Jean Ebrard, who was a co-author with Rebecca Scott of Freedom Papers, you know, every time for over the years that we were working on this, he would be like, what about Brazil? Where's Brazil?
And you know, needed a third co-author.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. We would have had to have a third co-author because neither of us is enough of, you know, has the Portuguese or the skills really to do Portugal. But it is an argument for collaboration, you know, and what we might have. Might have been a different book if we'd.
Well, and I think you just bring up a really fantastic point, is that once you begin to understand the South as not just this kind of, as you said, hermetically sealed off place, it is a part of this wider Atlantic world, a wider Caribbean world, the Western Hemisphere, and it is engaging with all of these different societies and people from those societies. The possibilities are almost endless for the types of projects you can do. So I think that's really an important point that I hope readers take away from it, and I hope that Southern historians in particular begin to play around with more and more. It's just, what were these connections like, and how can we begin to do more comparative work and kind of place the South in this larger context? So, man, awesome stuff all the way around. Another thing that I find really cool is how you and Alejandro defined the law, and you make it very explicit at the beginning of the book. You stated that the law cannot be reduced to the illusory certitude of written edicts or statutes. You see things a little bit differently, and you brought this up a little bit, but I was hoping you could maybe explain your approach to the law and how that shaped your like research process and the arguments that you all crafted.
Sure. Yeah. I think that there's this is less true now than it was maybe 10 years ago, but it's still somewhat the case that social historians, many of whom use legal sources all the time, and and have done research in legal archives, nevertheless have an idea of the law as something really separate from social life, as something that you find in books. It's codes, it's high court opinions, and it's kind of, and there's a gap, right? There's this gap between law and actual practice life, as lived by ordinary people. And I really think that's a mistake, because, what we try to show is, if you think of law as simply people's encounters with the state, right? It's all of the places where people are encountering state power, and that's as we've learned from Foucault and many others, right? You can find it in lots of different places, right? There are a lot of different institutions at different levels, down to pretty mundane local levels, whether it's actual trials or encounters with, slave patrols, or even people who aren't representatives of the state, but they've been given the right because they're white to check your papers, that's illegal. That's something about the law as well, because the fact that you have to carry, if you're a free person of color, you have to keep papers with you at all times, and that you're in danger if you don't have them, right? That's a piece of the law as well. So defining law more broadly as these encounters of ordinary people with different kinds of legal institutions, but also taking seriously legal ideas and doctrines, because it's not, we're certainly not saying those codes don't matter at all, or what high courts say doesn't matter. Often it matters a lot. But kind of looking at the various different levels. And the other thing that does is allow you to see how even people from below can shape and influence legal development, right? One of the things that we argue in the book is it's enslaved and free people of color who were really pushing on the law, making claims that kind of expand and even create rights that didn't exist before, because they're kind of taking advantage of all of these, anytime that there's a little opening, they'll kind of push to expand that opening. And so that's why we really ended up focusing on freedom suits and these efforts of free people of color to expand their rights. When we started out, we thought it was going to be a study of law and slavery, and it ended up being really a study of law and freedom.
Yeah, and that's one of the really great contributions I think that this book makes, is it kind of flips the script a little bit, and it's looking at the ways in which laws and efforts to restrict what free people of color were able to do is really shaping the understanding of what it means to be Black and an enslaved person. I thought that was a really awesome and fresh perspective that was brought to this.
Thanks. And I think, in part, it feels fresh because it was kind of surprising to us. Like, it was not what we were expecting the book to be. And that, I think, is one of the, for me, one of the fun things about being a historian is that, we start out with hypotheses and arguments, but also what we find in the archives can really change and shape where, a project ends up going and what the argument ends up being. And I really, that's really exciting.
Well, I think it was great. And honestly, when I first read the book, I was a little concerned, like, okay, it's a comparative study. Are they just like recycling old arguments that other people are making and just saying, see, look, this is what it looked like in comparison. So I was not to denigrate anything you all were doing, but I was like, oh, this is great because it's a fresh perspective, not just a, hey, look, here's two things. Some things are similar, some things are different. So I think you all pulled off something that maybe many readers or skeptics of comparative work would say, I don't know if you really add anything fresh here, but you absolutely do. And I think that's something readers will take away immediately.
The other thing that was challenging about it, and part of why I think it did end up being more more focused, and I'm glad, is that we didn't want to do, there are aspects of it that are synthetic, of course, because you're covering, three and a half centuries and places. But, most of it is our own archival research. And to do that for the three places, that was a challenge in terms of part of why it took so long to write.
Conceiving of ways to get all of the book into a 45-minute, an hour-long discussion with you. It's like, how in the world are we going to do this? So listeners, just beware. We are condensing an awful lot of information, as Ariella just suggested, from like three centuries, three different places, into about 45 minutes. So let's dig in a little bit. You and Alejandro argued that the legal and social precedents that existed in Spain, France, and England mattered deeply to the development of these new slave societies in the early colonial period. What were some of those legal and social precedents, and how did they shape the development of race-based slavery in each society, or as many as we can fit into the next couple of minutes?
So this is, one of the surprises and one of the places where we diverge from earlier kind of classic comparative work like that of Tannenbaum or Herbert Klein, et cetera, from the mid-20th century, because we argued that these legal and social precedents, particularly in the Iberian world, particularly in Cuba, which is settled by the Spanish, who by the time they get to Cuba have already been enslaving Africans in the Mediterranean, for a century. And so they have kind of ready to hand a bunch of, local ordinances and so on that establish blackness as a degraded status. They already have that in the law, and they already have a pretty well-developed kind of racist ideology by the time they arrive that says black people are appropriate for enslavement and so they kind of hit the ground running in a way, even more so than is true in the early 18th century when Louisiana is settled by the French, or in the early 17th century, I should say, before the Virginia settled first, early 17th century when the British settled Virginia. But the French also come in with a bunch of experience enslaving Africans in Martinique, Guadeloupe, and so on. And so it's really in Virginia where there's much less in English law, much less precedent regarding some kind of basic legal questions, like how will slave status be passed down? Does baptism make you free? And so it's remarkable that in 17th century Virginia, we still see cases where someone's able to win freedom because her father is free. Or someone is able to win freedom because they're Christian. That's shut down by the end of the 17th century. And so by the time you get to the early 18th century, all three colonies are kind of in the same place, which is they've established in their law that, blackness and African descent is if not synonymous with slavery, they're doing, you know, trying to bring those closer together.
Yeah, what were the impacts of that early experience with slavery or enslaving people of African descent that the Spanish and the French, to an extent, had? How did that shape those early settlements in ways that maybe differed from Virginians, where they were kind of coming up with this all on their own? Would you argue? I guess another way of saying that, would you say that the Virginia colony was more fluid in terms of kind of race equating with degraded status than say comparing to a place like Cuba?
I'd say in its first maybe 50 years that was true. And you know, and that's somewhat ironic in that the typical comparison or you know, certainly like the Tannenbaum thesis had been, you know, that the Spanish colonies were more fluid, more open, less black and white, and maybe less harsh as well. But it doesn't last long in Virginia. And in the early 18th century, the real, two things actually separate Louisiana and Virginia on the one hand from Cuba on the other. And those are the restriction on manumission, which in Louisiana is written into the first code in 1724, the first code law. In Virginia, it's only really by late first 1691, then 1723, they try to, you know, shut down or greatly restrict manumission. And then the other is limiting interracial marriage, which similarly is written into the Code Noir in Louisiana, and in Virginia is only added in later in the 17th century. But both of those things really don't happen in Cuba. And in particular, manumission is never limited in Cuba. And that ends up becoming really important.
So yeah, I think that was a really interesting point in the book, is that these societies that began with less experience with enslaving African and African descendant people started to curtail manumissions, and the society that had much more experience enslaving Africans and African descendant people kept that window open, which is an important divergence, which I promise listeners we will get to as we go through the course of the book. And as you just suggested, Ariella, in the long run, you and Alejandro argue that the obstacles that Virginia and Louisiana place in the way of manumissions, first in this colonial period and then again in the antebellum period, produce dramatic results. You state communities of free people of color attain significant numbers in Cuba, while those in Virginia and Louisiana dwindled. And this is really where the rest of the book unfolds, is in this kind of divergent trajectory between Cuba and what would eventually be the entirety of the U.S. South. So you brought up manumissions and interracial sex and marriage being one of the arenas that are increasingly curtailed in the United States or in the U.S. South. What is the concern over interracial marriage and manumission for these slave societies? Why do they begin to crack down on these two aspects?
So manumission in particular is always associated with, fears of rebellion. So often it's at moments where there is some rebellion that has involved free people of color, bringing sort of news of freedom to enslaved people, right? But also, often it's rebellions that involve free people of African descent And others, whether it's Europeans, Indians, indigenous people. So some of these are efforts to crack down on that kind of coalition, political coalition, if you want, and in particular to make clearer this line that to align status with race, right? That that freedom is reserved for white people, and that enslaved status is where African people belong or African descended people belong, and free people of color really challenge that. And especially when they make claims on citizenship or when they kind of try to expand their rights. And so you go through different periods when that crackdown seems really urgent to white slaveholding elites. And it's also, it's true in Cuba as well. Like Cuban elites would love to get rid of or curtail the power of communities of free people of color. It's just that both demographically, sort of just in terms of numbers, it's not easy for them to do. They also play an economic role that to some extent is played by white people in the U.S. colonies. And so it's just, much harder for Cuban elites to, and sometimes they even say, they look longingly over, across the water and say, like, wouldn't it be great if we could do what they're doing in Virginia or something?
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, to me, when I was reading this, you think, okay, well, if you're trying to create these clear distinctions between, white, free, black, enslaved, the two most important fields you're going to attack are manumissions, which are creating free or communities of free people of color. So blurring that line, black doesn't necessarily equate with enslaved status. And then interracial marriages, you can't create these stark dividing lines on race if those racial lineages are blending. And I think that's something that is really kind of drawn out in this book is, there's these efforts to crack down. And then as you pointed out, especially in places like Cuba, the efforts of the communities of free people of color to push back against those, that is really where your definition of the law begins to become really important, right? It's not just about the effort, but about the pushback and what that pushback ends up resulting in. So could you talk a little bit about why, and you brought this up a little bit, but maybe elaborate on it, why the communities of free people of color in Cuba were more successful at resisting those efforts to crack down, whereas their counterparts in Virginia or Louisiana perhaps were less successful to push back right against enslaved peoples?
Right. Goals. I mean, our answer to that is to a large extent a political one. In the United States, and this is really becomes really starts to kick in around the 1830s in particular. So we talk about the kind of middle chapter of our book looks at the Age of Revolution, which we periodized from, the 1760s through to 1830 or so, as a time of kind of expanding freedom in each of these three places, and then there's a backlash, and what's happening in the United States is that at the very moment that freedom, equality, democracy are kind of expanding for, at least theoretically, for white people or for white men, that is making the situation of free people of color especially precarious, because if you're extending, voting rights, for example, to all white men, regardless of their property holding and so on, and you're saying, okay, now citizenship means the right to vote and all of these important rights of sitting on juries and so on, and you can have that just because you're white now, then it becomes very dangerous to have men who are free, who are not white, saying, we should be getting these rights too. And so so-called white men's democracy, right? That ideology is a very racialized kind of defense of slavery as a positive good, but also of this idea that free people of color should just be removed. And so colonization, the colonization movement that, you know, starts out with a little bit of anti-slavery tinge to it, you know, early on, right? This idea that, like, we'll emancipate the slaves and then send them to back to Africa, quickly becomes a much more kind of punitive and harsh idea of just forcibly removing free people of color to Liberia and giving people a choice. In fact, you know, the only way that you can become emancipate someone or that they can become free is if they are put on a ship to Africa. And so so I guess that's to say that the political impetus in a republic moved against communities of color, and ironically, in a more traditional, you know, monarchical society where there's very clear, you know, you become free, you don't become a, it's not a question of becoming a citizen, you become free, you just take your place in a very hierarchical society. That said, I was really struck by how long it took, right? That, you know, there's this effort to crack down on free people of color that in some ways starts as early as 1806 in Virginia. They're like trying to restrict manumission, but freedom suits are still being brought in remarkable numbers way past, for decades past that. And then in 1830, after Nat Turner and, you know, all of this threat of abolitionists, you've got David Walker's appeal, all this stuff. So all of these local and state regulations being passed against free people of color. And yet they're still finding ways to become free. They're still active communities, really until well into like even the 1850s, say, in Louisiana. So I was also just struck by how long it took, really, to and how much work it was to try to suppress these very creative efforts of free people of color to expand their rights.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this revolutionary moment. You've got the American Revolution. You've got the revolutions taking place across the Atlantic world, the Haitian Revolution. And you and Alejandro made the case that in fact, in the efforts to shore up existing institutions in these revolutionary places, even in the United States, but also in Cuba as well. This actually provided a little window for Africans and African descended people who were enslaved to kind of press some of these claims or these freedom suits, as you call them. Could you maybe just give us a couple of examples of ways that enslaved people could make a claim on their freedom?
Absolutely.
In any of the societies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's this idea, I think, that the expansion of freedom in the Age of Revolution is just from sort of, you know, this contagion of liberty idea and just, you know, people get the news and there's something to that. And certainly in terms of the news of Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. Haiti was extremely inspiring across the Atlantic world to enslaved people. In terms of more opportunities to claim freedom within the law, some of those were actually the byproduct of these kind of retrenchment efforts. So one example is in Cuba, there was the practice of coartación, or self-purchase on an installment plan, essentially, where you would an enslaved person could pay a portion of her price, and then be the owner would be contractually obligated to sell her freedom if she could come up with the rest of the price.
So this is not an owner-initiated manumission.
Right, exactly. It can be initiated by the, they have to come to an agreement, but but once that's entered into, it starts to come with a bunch of other prerogatives. And coartación really expands during this period as a result of some Bourbon reforms, which are efforts to shore up the imperial system, including new taxes that are imposed that lead to an increasing focus of the crown on what's happening with coartación. They create a new official position of the síndico procurador, who is sort of actually has as part of their role to represent the subordinated peoples in the local area, and including enslaved people. And they're not answerable to the colonial elites. They're answerable directly to the crown. And so that's really important as well. So it's during this period, enslaved people really press on the coartación practice to kind of gain ancillary rights to go along with that, such as the idea of fractional self-ownership. You know, if I have paid 50% of my price, well, 50% of my labor should belong to me, and I should be paid wages for that and be able to put those wages towards my purchase price. Mm-hmm. That's important. The idea of carrying paper that you could find another owner, a new owner who would be willing to pay the remainder of the price, and then force a sale, even if the original owner didn't want to, which also gave a way for the community of free people of color to help purchase kin members, community members, by pooling their funds, for example. And in the United States, there were also in Virginia, for example, there was also kind of some unexpected or unintended consequences of legislation that's passed during this period. Like, there's a ban on importation of slaves into Virginia.
This was my favorite part of the book, if I'm being honest.
From neighboring states, mainly Maryland, and that was a purely you know, it's like a regional effort to, you know, shore up prices by controlling the supply. And, but in the legislation is a penalty for the importation ban, which includes emancipation of the slave. And enslaved people start taking advantage of that by suing for freedom in large numbers, saying, hey, I was imported illegally and I should be free, and winning these suits in large numbers. And it keeps going. Even in 1806, they closed the loophole. And as I found cases as late as 1830, where people are still suing, saying, you know, I was brought into the state before 1806, and therefore, or my mother was, you know, and so I should be free. So
I thought that's where that argument of like people shaping the law and how it functions was just so obvious and so unexpected. You know, I think we typically don't think, you know, kind of general audiences don't necessarily think of enslaved people as kind of engaged with legal practices or laws that are coming out, right? Their world is the plantation. But yet you all make a very powerful case that not only are they in tune with the nuances of the law, they're acting on it in ways that are forcing a manumission. And I think, again, when we think about free communities of color, we think like, okay, it was a slave owner on his deathbed and emancipated all of his or her slaves. But no, you all demonstrate very clearly that it is enslaved people in many cases that are pushing the issue and bringing about their own emancipation, in many cases against the wishes of the person that claims them as property. And I thought that was just a really telling point of the entire book.
Yeah, and I would also say that one of the things that really surprised me was just the level of kind of legal knowledge and how it's diffused, that there were just numerous examples and places where we saw, you know, for example, Louisiana changes hands to the Spanish in 1763. And almost as soon as the governor arrives, you start seeing coartación being brought by enslaved people in Louisiana. It's like they've already got the news that that this is possible under Spanish law. And then as late as the 1840s, they're still making claims based on that Spanish law, even though it's been the United States for several decades. And I was most amazed by this case I found, it called Francois versus Lebrano, that was, I think, 1848, not positive about the year, but it's the 1840s, where the claimant said he was a hatter, and he said, you know, I paid 5/8 of my purchase price, so I should have gotten wages for 5/8 of my time. And, you know, that was a really standard claim under the practice of coartación. It wasn't uncontested. It wasn't like you won every time on that, but it was a claim that was often made in Cuba and in Louisiana before the American took over. And, you know, the American court in Louisiana just says like, oh, that's ridiculous. They kind of make fun of the lawyer for bringing it, you know, and I'm thinking, how did they know? You know, right. That's incredible.
Well, again, as we kind of make our quick traipse through 300 years of history in three different places, I do just want to kind of, you know, emphasize that even though there are these cases being brought and the book demonstrates how enslaved people and free people of color are familiar with the law and making the law bend in some cases in ways that benefit them, overwhelmingly in the United States South, the rights and privileges that free people of color maybe could have once laid claim to are increasingly being eroded. Whereas in Cuba, those communities are able to hold on to some of those traditional rights much more successfully. So what were, and as briefly as maybe you possibly can, what were some of the privileges and rights that were being stripped away from free communities of color in the United States that made this connection between blackness and enslavement much more firm?
Yeah, I mean, starting in the 1830s and especially in the 1850s, what you see are just the exclusion of people of color from public life, kind of the impossibility of the claims to citizenship that many free people of color are making, but they're kind of hitting this wall. So if, for example, you know, in New Orleans, there's a militia of free people of color. They fight in the Battle of New Orleans, you know, in the War of 1812. By 1834, that's shut down completely. There's an act of, you know, kind of social life in the cities of Virginia and Louisiana, you know, big black churches, there are some schools. Those are being either shut down or kind of put under white tutelage. And then some very basic, you know, just rights of mobility. So I mentioned, you know, having to carry papers. One of the things you see in the archives, right, are hundreds of certificates of good character that people had to carry with them to avoid either being kidnapped and re-enslaved because they didn't have proof that they were free, but also you know, to keep them from violence, and they would carry these certificates sort of saying, you know, here are all the white people in my neighborhood who vouch for me, in effect. And then, you know, kind of heart-rendingly, you know, also tons of advertisements in Southern newspapers when someone lost their papers, right? Because that was so dangerous. Like, I lost my free papers, please return these to me. And so as all these laws are being passed saying that no free people of color can remain in the state or the Commonwealth, and they have to leave the state or even leave the country, right? It just becomes almost impossible to live as a free person of color by the 1850s. And both Virginia and Louisiana by 1860 have passed so-called re-enslavement laws, which say if you want to stay in the state, you have to choose a new master. And, you know, and a few people even do that. I mean, very few. But I think it shows just the incredible pressure that is put on the remaining population of free people of color.
Yeah, and this is where the book really gets that argument from, right? It's in the ability to restrict freedom and define what it means to be a free person of color, or restrict what it means to be a free person of color, that this connection between blackness and enslaved status really becomes much more firm in the United States in ways that it didn't necessarily develop in a place like Cuba. So can I just say, as an aside, Alejandro was going to join us. His schedule just got pretty hectic here right before we were going to record, so he had to drop out. But you have done a masterful job of tracing the history of Cuba, Virginia, Louisiana over three centuries. I'm hoping everybody is giving you a standing ovation for how well you just navigated across time and place. But if we could zoom out just a little bit. In the preface early on, you both state that you don't necessarily believe that there's a straight line from the past you explore in the book to the present day, but you believe that understanding the origins of race across the New World requires us to study slavery and the slave trade from their beginnings. And so as kind of a parting thought, why do you think it's imperative for us to look at the origins of slavery to better understand the world that we find ourselves in today?
So I think, unfortunately, we still see so many echoes of the world as certainly as we see it by 1860, when we end the book, right? That the first of all, the regulation of free people of color provides the template for the Black codes immediately after the Civil War, and even, you know, a remarkable number of ways that race is entrenched in the law far beyond the Black codes, because of course it's and very often you'll hear courts referring back to those laws regulating free people of color, when they say, for example, in Plessy versus Ferguson and the civil rights cases and in various cases, when they say citizenship can't possibly mean all of these civil rights you're claiming, how do we know? Well, we know because before the Civil War, free Black people didn't have those rights. And so that link that's formed between whiteness and citizenship and the law in the United States has just been unfortunately incredibly durable. And it's not only with respect to Black people, right? The Chinese Exclusion Acts and our limits on immigration, I think, owe a lot to the limitations on the mobility of free Black people at, before the war. So, I think we're still dealing with the legacies of what we, the history that we trace in this book.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways you kind of make a point that was also present in the beginning of the book, where you say it was the Spanish experience enslaving Africans for so long that allowed them to kind of jump into Cuba ready to form these boundaries because they already existed. And in many ways, after the Civil War is over, it is the decades spent regulating free communities of color that allow white Americans to kind of jump back in and say, no, this is how we're going to define this new status. It's not slavery, but it's certainly not going to be equality because of that holdover. Well, Dr. Ariella J. Gross, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. The book is Becoming Free, Becoming Black, Race, Freedom, and Law in Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, and is available now through Columbia University Press and anywhere else you want to find. I'm sorry, Cambridge University Press. I apologize. Or anywhere else you find your books. Thank you so much for coming on. And again, we apologize that Alejandro couldn't make it. So I doubly appreciate you filling in for him as well. And thank you for listening to New Books in the American South.